This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Curioso, and welcome back to the Welsh History Podcast, episode 212, Hester Lynch Salisbury, part 1, Strength, Not Delicacy. I have in the past lamented that often the voices we hear in history usually come from certain categories of people. Typically, they are rich, within organizations that have been literate for a long time, or, in some cases, were the only ones doing the important documentations which were seen as part of their jobs. In ancient history, most of the writers were one of two kinds of people, someone with time on their hands and someone who was driven to chronicle things to represent their own religious or political viewpoint. Egyptian writers were typically religious people who were commemorating the dead, usually rich or powerful people. Or they were writing treaties or letters to various other leaders across North Africa and the Middle East for various reasons and issues. We frequently get windows into learning through these educational tablets or random surviving merchant arrangements, which were kept like receipts or legal documents. But it wasn't until the classical period that most of the writing that we initially had received had come from academics, poets, as well as the power brokers like Caesar and Tacitus, who were by no means normal people, end quote. That will change at the moment we found Pompeii and Herculaneum, and the joy that are the cursed tablets. We finally found people graffitiing what would have been viewed as the more normal writings of the day, from hero-worshipping gladiators to dissing local politicians to generally bad-mouthing some businesses. This was more what the human and natural side of ourselves, and it was what was coming out in the written word. And it was one that we could all obviously relate to. In Wales, for most of its history, writing was left to religious clerics or monks, or to the wealthy, if any at all, could even write, and some who had the poetry in their souls to mark down what they thought in meter and rhyme. Most of this writing was not really about things that we might relate to, such as the daily life or a chronicle of a farmer who was mad at his local neighbor who had stole his two prize sheep, or to the rich person who was robbed by some local brigand, or even some of the basics of day-to-day living. Much of what we know about this doesn't come to us until the last century or so. Through these periods, times were finally changing. We were finally getting to see the voices that up until now were largely hidden from us, none more so than the voices of women. Yes, we know of a few famous historical women in Welsh history. Let's be honest, most of this, of course, was the point of view of men. They were usually objects to be leered over, or to be talked about, or gossiped about, depending on the circumstance and situation. They were rarely people that were considered to be important unless they were important by who comes from their genealogy, something of an issue we've seen over the years. And this was finally starting to shift as more and more everyday people were being educated and more were finding out that they had something to say, and some, as we will see, still follow the pattern of men, but others were finally saying different things and bringing up key views that were largely missing up until this period. Yet, we have finally reached a period in Welsh history where women were not only playing significant roles in society, but also were able to talk about that role instead of being MacGuffins for men who are so often the so-called true leads of the story. One of the greatest things that the Enlightenment and the cultural revival in Wales did for society was to finally give us the voices of those left in darkness. So it was with that mindset, I want you to meet one of these people in this episode. Hester Lynch Salisbury was born in Carnarvonshire around 1740 or 1741. She was born to a wealthy landholder named Sir John Salisbury and her mother, Hester Lynch Cotton. They were landholders in the area who at one time during their ancestry had owned a considerable amount of land and had controlled quite a lot of power in the area. Thanks to that aristocracy, the Salisburys were able to rise up the ranks, initially due to connections with the early Tudors, but by the 18th century were figures of great deal of influence in northwest Wales. However powerful that they may have been, it did not mean that they knew how to manage their financial affairs terribly well, and Sir John was a bit of a mess. Despite his position in society, his money issues meant that his family were frequently close to poverty. As well, his treatment of his family was abysmal. John and Hester Cotton married for love, but his frequent bouts of violence and anger made living with him an unwelcome part of life. As written by his daughter, quote, "For a woman to contend with a man, she is shut up with a distance from society, where the natural roughness of the sex is not restrained, and gallantry can obtain no reputation, is so dangerous that I wonder almost how she escaped with her life. After several miscarriages from frights, contests, falls, etc., my mother did produce a child." End quote. That child being Hester. For Hester, her mother and her uncles were the keys to her success. Her mother taught her stories and a love of family history, as well as how to read and write at a young age. Her uncle Robert, on her mother's side, doted on her and seemingly accorded her, at least to her own accounts, everything that she desired. It was her uncle Thomas, however, her father's brother, in London, who helped to educate her further and allowed Hester to explore cultural writings of some of the most famous authors of the city. Eventually, this would include Samuel Johnson, who made an appearance in this podcast previously, a number of episodes back. Johnson was the first writer of the English Dictionary and fairly familiar with Welsh London circles. He is a person that will matter in her later life, but will be someone we'll bring up in a later episode and talk about in more depth with. Eventually, John would be given a place on an expedition to the colony of Nova Scotia under Lord Halifax. He was hoping to repair the lost fortune and to gain the financial clout to be able to deal with the problems that they had been falling under. He also went alone, leaving his wife and daughter in England. In Nova Scotia, he appears to have found some success, as he was an effective bureaucrat who served the British government after the settlement of Halifax. However, he did not enjoy his time there. He was, in fact, quite miserable and had wished to return home very shortly after arriving, according to some writers, suffering from a version of depression in the isolated colony. He would only get brief respites from Nova Scotia, but Hester and her mother were living at least frugally while he was away, and generally it seemed to be getting on without his influence. While the family debt kept John firmly in Halifax and unable to leave due to the need for that money, that gave him more reasons to be upset, and when he did return home, at times it would lead to violence. During these periods, Hester and her mother, however, would spend a large amount of time with family in and around Wales, whether at Llywenny Hall in the Vale of Clwyd, or in Herefordshire, where she spent a fair amount of time eventually at the manor house Offaly. As part of her education, Hester set on attempting to learn Latin and Spanish, a chore Professor Michael Franklin describes as a way to ingrate herself with her aunt, Anna Maria, who spoke both languages. While it is not expressly said, but you are left to wonder whether this is part of the reason she is positioned as heir to her uncle Thomas and Robert, because she was able to win them over due to her ability to learn skills and to match them in their interests, especially in education. Considering the financial plight of the family, Hester's ability to be a people pleaser, even at a young age, likely helped her both with her hot-headed father and the various relations who were better situated financially. At 17, she began a friendship, and some argue a romance, with Dr. Arthur Collier, whose intellect Hester considered unmatched, but whose inability to fit into social norms of the day seemed to put others off, but encouraged and intrigued Hester. If you're like me and eating healthy is a bit of a problem, let me bend your ear a little bit to eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggies. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. Also, if you're looking for gourmet meals, try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/WelshHistoryPod50 and use the code WelshHistoryPod50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code WelshHistoryPod50 at factormeals.com/WelshHistoryPod50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hello, my name is Peter Zablocki, and I'm a historian, author, and college professor. I'm thrilled to invite you to check out Evergreen Network's History Shorts podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, join me on a journey through time, exploring the little-known and hidden gems of history. In each bite-sized episode, I'll dive into my original research to bring you intriguing historical curiosities you've probably never heard of, uncovering the fascinating stories that have shaped our world, from forgotten figures to overlooked events. And the best part? I've condensed all this historical goodness into manageable chunks, perfect for your on-the-go lifestyle. Whether you're commuting to work or squeezing in a quick break, History Shorts fits into the little time you probably think you don't have. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of the History Shorts podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
She then received instruction from Reverend William Parker, a chaplain under George II and III. He helped her refine her Latin and French. In each case, and with all these various patrons, Hester continued to develop a poetic voice and a strong literary mind. As part of her instruction, she would also be tasked with translating works of various languages, which would then expand her understanding of these languages, and it forced her to come to grips, especially with Romance grammar, since she was specialized in Spanish, Italian, French, and Latin. Hester's education continued to grow, and her desire to build on her literary career helped her with the free translation of Louis Racine's first, and I'm probably going to massacre this, but we'll do our best, quote, Epître sur l'homme, which she entitled The Essay on Man. Displays of this growing intellectual and literary confidence meant that she was in a position where she was becoming noticed, one that modern scholars have lauded and remarked on how much she had grown in this confidence and how often the right the work she was doing were making a massive difference on the lives of other people. The death of Anna Maria in 1759 after another miscarriage had led Hester to memorialize her with a poem, one that her Uncle Thomas cherished, but one that Hester in later life seemed to view with dubious merit because, as she said, quote, "This trifling performance brought tears into my uncle's eyes and money into my pocket for having celebrated so artfully," end quote. That her family encouraged this kind of profiteering may have jaded her in later life towards these earlier works. Hester, in her own writing, seemed to see her aunt as powerful because of how strong her intellect was and how educated Anna Marie was, which bothered her parents because in her eyes, they saw themselves as inferior to her and did not appreciate that inferiority. Because of these musings, I'm left to question whether the poem she claimed to come from a desire for financial gain had more likely started as a way to honor this person that she considered important in her teenage life, so much so that she believed Anna Maria had been the one pushing for her to become her own almost child and to become the heir to the family fortune. However, eventually, the family was given some money as Thomas offered the manor at Offley that we mentioned earlier in Hitchin, Herefordshire, as a place for them to live. This would be accompanied by a £10,000 inheritance, which would secure the family to the delight of John from the financial ruin, which was just around the corner, it seemed, for all of Hester's childhood. However, this great fortune and great success did not last, as conflict followed John's relationship with his family quite frequently. In the meantime, Hester had turned 20, and now marriage had become a point, at least for her mother, who saw that presenting her daughter a good match with the right type of person would be key to her success. Whether it for herself or for her family, I couldn't tell you, but certainly that was something that went into it, no doubt. For John, no matter which man it was, they would never be good enough for his daughter, and certainly not the man who had caught the eye of her mother, Henry Thale, the local brewer's son. Thale may have gained independent wealth thanks to his brewery, but he did not have the aristocratic background so craved by John, and with that opinion alone had disqualified Henry to woo his daughter. As for Hester, she was focused far more on publishing for the first time and spent far many more hours sending out numbers of letters and stories and ideas in verses under pseudonyms, attempting to get herself published, featuring fantasy stories and prose around various quasi-historical ideas. One such story was around a North American tribe of natives whom she made up a grand story about, something that would be relatively obvious to modernize, but certainly influential in the eyes of the people of her day. She would also write political commentary, which would attack the current Prime Minister, Tory John Stuart, the 3rd Earl of Bute. Bute had come under condemnation in part because of the negotiations surrounding the Treaty of Paris, which ended the Seven Years' War. Effectively, Bute was seen to have given away too much and been too kind to Spain and France, something that was seen as a faux pas and worth his being removed from office. She would write political commentary that would attack this prime minister, and John's old boss, the Earl of Halifax, who served in the government of Bute, himself had little love for the prime minister. In fact, as far as the prime minister was concerned, and as certainly as far as the opposition was concerned, no one loved him, and the only one who actually did was King George III, and that was the only reason why he had the office in the first place. Meanwhile, for the radicals, he was in the way and causing problems. For people like Hester, he had upended the role that William Pitt and the Earl of Newcastle had in the government, and thus was in the way of that. In fact, in the article that she wrote, she even calls him a dirty Scottish boy. Obviously quite derogatory. Radicals may have liked this attack, as they would reprint this work in their own articles and newspapers, something that would have been a surprise had they known it had come from an establishment aristocratic household. In the midst of these attempts at getting published, her father once again had fought with his brother, and because of this, as we mentioned earlier, his constant conflicts with his family, it meant that he was forced to abandon the manor in Hereford and return to London, penniless and in a problematic situation. Yet this had not stopped the visits of Henry Thale, who maintained his interest regardless of what the father and daughter thought. In the end, John Salisbury died on December 18, 1762, likely brought on due to the agitation over various family issues, not the least of which his concern about the constant appeals for the hand of Hester by Henry Thales. But it would be the remarriage of his brother which would send him out to try and discuss what he should do with friends and relatives. Likely, this was because so much of the fortune rested on Thomas, he likely and rightly feared that with a new family, Thomas would have less need to honor his commitments to Hester, and by extension, John, and that she would no longer be considered important enough to inherit his wealth. In a state of upset, John had gone out to visit others to get advice and to deal with, as best he could, this coming issue, but instead was taken by a sudden stroke and had passed away. Now both mother and daughter were dealing with the consequences of this death and the massive amounts of debt that John was never able to clear, and it was at this moment of crisis that the two women were never farther apart on what to do about it and how to deal with the constant position of Henry Thales in their lives and what each wanted from that particular arrangement. And with that, I'd like to thank you for listening. I hope you're having a great day. If you have any questions, comments, and concerns, you can always reach me at the Welsh History Podcast at gmail.com, or you can contact me via Twitter at Welsh History Pod, or on Facebook at facebook.com/Welsh History Podcast. And if you would like, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/Welsh History. Any donations there are used to help pay for the research done for this series, and I appreciate all of them. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you have a great day. We'll talk to you later. Take care. Bye-bye. Welsh History Podcast is a member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To find more information on them, you can do so at evergreenpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.
History is the greatest adventure story, but does it ever leave you wondering what the women were doing all that time? This is Lori from the Her Half of History podcast, and the answer is that some women were seizing power, or escaping slavery, or spying for their country, or creating artistic masterpieces, while countless others were doing the laundry, getting married, and wondering why their clothes don't have more pockets. If you would like to hear the stories of women doing all of those things, check out Her Half of History at herhalfofhistory.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis, introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.